Please mind the gap between the train and the platform.
This is Barbican Station.
Hello and welcome to Barbican Station. My name is Jeff, I'll be your host today, and we are here to talk all things McCarran, and in this case, we are here to talk about Season 3, Episode 6 of Slow Horses, Footprints, and in this case, I am so excited to welcome Matthew Bradford back to talk through all of this episode, and we're going to dive deep in this. Matthew, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be back, and it feels like we were just recording the recap of the first episode. These seasons are so short. It flew by.
It did. It was like you watch it and you want to binge it, and it feels like you binge it because by the time we get to the end, it's been so quick, but it really has flown by. And wow, what an epic ending to this season, right? I mean, you know, I was talking last episode about how one of the things I really wish watching this season in particular is that they had done the first four episodes individually, and this episode they just released 5 and 6 at the same time. Do you agree with that? Do you think it would have been better served if we'd seen 5 and 6 in one kind of go? It felt so much like those two were so closely connected.
Yeah, that's a good point. That hadn't occurred to me, but you're right. Of course, they had really conceived what they hoped would be a big cliffhanger for the end of 5 that wouldn't have served much purpose if you had both episodes. But beyond that, yeah, you're right. They do seem, it's almost like a two-parter.
Yeah, it felt like a full movie, like a two-hour movie kind of thing going on there. But wow, what an ending. And they really kind of brought home so many of the plot that threads that we saw early through the season. I mean, we see so many things threaded throughout, right? We see this double-decker bus that comes back into things. We see Catherine talking about Charlie Partner, River disdainful of these files that he's bringing. And in the end, that comes back around so strongly here, right? I mean, so many things that we just see, they really do a good job of landing the plane, I thought, in this episode.
Yeah, you know, I'm not really a fan of binge watching in general, and would rather have my shows spaced out every week for the most part. But at the end of these seasons, I really want to go back now and watch this pretty much straight through, just because I think a lot of these will pay off better seen back to back to back, like you're suggesting. And also because the season's so short, it just really would sort of lend itself to that. So yeah, maybe they should just dump all of them at once. I mean, if they were all dumped at once, I would watch them all at once. That's the thing. And but it might work well for this series with just 6 episodes a season.
So let's jump to the start, right? I mean, we start off catching up with what happened there, and we see River dealing with the explosion that he is caught in there, which was really, you know, as we said last episode, so cinematic, right? I mean, and that's one of the things I'd say about this entire episode. It really kind of upped the, I don't know, you're the movie expert, you tell me what it's called, but like upped the cinematic stakes of the show in general, it felt like. You know, I just felt like there was more to it this season, and especially at the end here. I don't know. Do you agree or disagree?
Yeah. Well, from like we talked about at the start with the Istanbul opening, it set a tone that, yeah, this is going to be a more cinematic season. I'm not sure that I'd say more. I mean, it is very cinematic, but I'm not sure I'd say more so than the others, because I would say, I think more it's a different kind of cinema. You know, like, in the previous 2 seasons, we were seeing a version of Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, and this season we were seeing a version of The Bourne Supremacy.
Mm, you know, it's a nice,
a different sort of cinematic.
Yeah,
I mean, I think that from the start, the show has been very cinematic, but
sure,
this one was an action movie. You know, whereas previous ones were more cerebral, and that sort of follows the book. You know, by far the biggest action sequence in the series up to that point is this shootout in the book. I'm talking about is the shootout at the file repository, and so it makes total sense that it would be the biggest action scene in the series too, warranting basically, like you say, a two-part episode to cover it all. And, you know, this was kind of Herron's first experiment with, I'd say, action cinema,
yeah.
You know, and, but we do get some other big, it's not like it becomes the norm for the books, you know, like,
mm-hmm.
so I don't think we're going to see the series change its tone permanently to be Jason Bourne, but we will see some other big action scenes in other seasons. But, you know, I mean, I think it's great that the books can really sort of go back and forth, and you can have one that is much more of that Le Carre kind of file room spying, and then another that is file room blowing up instead.
Yeah.
You know, like this. But what struck me about the beginning, well, the end of the last episode and the beginning of this one, is the cheat. And that's not cinematic at all. That's pure television, because you can't do that cheat in cinema except in the old serials, where it ended last week essentially with River getting blown up. And then this week, it doesn't really track to the, we just see him lying there and he's not even covered in files. You know, at the very least, after that explosion last week, I would expect all those shelves on top of him and him covered in files. But he's just lying there kind of dazed, and Louisa pats his cheek a little and gets him and revives him. So it goes from seeming like he might be dead to, oh no, that's just a quick thing, let's move on. And that reminds me of, yeah, like the old serial cliffhanger endings, or the great Bruce Campbell show from the 90s, The Adventures of Briscoe County Jr., which would parody that. Do you remember that?
Oh, I loved that show. That was a classic. No.
Yeah, one of my favorites. At every ad break, it would seem like Briscoe was dead, because it would go just a little bit further, and then after the commercials, it would almost rewind a little bit so that the train wasn't quite as close to hitting him as he thought it was, you know, going to be at the previous commercial break. And that's what this was like. It seems, how on earth can River even survive this, to, oh, it didn't really matter.
Yes.
And that's legit. You know, I'm not complaining about that. That is television, you know, and it's something you can do on television. So that is not cinematic. You know, you can't do that with a movie.
Sure. We'll save our Briscoe fandom for a separate podcast. No, I love that show. And I think you're right that there's an element that has been in Herron's book from the start that plays to television, which is that playing with the reader / viewer and their expectations and all of that. And so I think that really kind of plays into that very well.
You're right. Yeah, that's really almost like what we were talking about during our discussion of episode one, how sometimes Herron's description will, you know, describe a whole sequence without letting you know what character you're reading about, and you can't really do that on TV. That this is almost like the televisual equivalent of that, you know, like it's something you can do in TV that's very much in keeping with those tricks that he pulls on the reader.
Yeah. As always, great lines. Like, we could spend this whole episode just repeating great lines, and I'll probably do a significant portion of that in this. But, you know, you have Louisa saying, "You just killed an MI5 officer."
Right.
And then the guy yelling back, "Who do you think sent us?" You know, I mean, just like really right away setting the stakes, right? They're on their own. They are going to have to figure this out, because they're not having the cavalry come here. And, you know, we get a shot of Ben, who is obviously toast here. River makes it through, but Ben, not so much.
Right. Although that was already clear at the end of the last episode. I mean, we knew he was dead.
Yeah. But like, I think that just set the stakes.
Yeah.
I think that was interesting. And I loved the fun lighting that they used in this whole sequence in the bunker, you know, like they're in this file room and all of a sudden, for whatever reason, doesn't make a lot of sense, but like everything is green. But like the other room is all red, and it just like you could tell the director of photography was having a lot of fun with just lighting the different scenes and really having fun with that.
Another thing that I guess this goes to your cinematic comment, you know, they've really, the art direction on creating this file set, it's not how I pictured it in the book, but I mean, it's what it totally makes sense for it to be on television. Is the filed facility itself the way you pictured it?
Sort of, you know, I mean, it had this kind of bunker feel, and it felt like a bunker that they were at. Bouncing back to that a little bit, I love how in the first episode we get it, and gosh, you don't really, like, even I, having read the books, I didn't flash to why they were showing us the bunker in the very first episode with Taverner going there, right? I mean, now it's like, duh. But then even it didn't make a whole lot of sense. But wow, really some good writing there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you want to set that up. It's certainly the major location of this season. Of course, we have the two storylines happening. You know, while this is going on, we've also got Lamb and Roddy Ho arriving at the farmhouse where the kidnappers have been holding up. But now it's only...
I think Sarah.
Yeah, she's the only one still there with Catherine. Now, I don't remember these two scenes playing out concurrently in the book the way that they do here. I thought that one of them came after the other. But again, as I mentioned the first time we discussed this book, it's been a long time now since I read it. So I could be wrong about that. And Heron does do a lot of intercut sequences where he'll, you know, there'll be two things going on and he'll cut chapter to chapter. I just don't remember these two as having been like that. Do you recall?
I feel like there was some intercutting here. Now, again, don't hold me to it because I'd have to go back to the book, but I do feel like, yeah, it was somewhat connected, yeah.
But they're two great set pieces, you know, they're two very memorable things from the book, and they make very memorable TV as well.
Well, and perfect for intercutting, right? I mean, because we really have three stories going on here. We've got the sequence at the farmhouse with Lamb and Catherine. We've got Louisa and River, and we've got Shirley and Marcus. And I feel like it's like kind of like a Star Wars movie here, right? Where, you know, they always have those three sequences intercutting, and it really felt like that. And it worked. It really worked. And I didn't feel lost ever between the cuts, between the different sequences. A lot of that comes down to, I think, like we said, the director of photography lighting things differently so you can instantly tell where you're at and what's going on.
Yeah, and the art direction. Yeah, they're three very distinct locations, even if two of them are essentially the same location. The exterior and the interior are clearly distinct from each other. So, yes, you don't get lost.
Let's talk about Louisa and River and kind of their journey, right? Because River is revived. We've got Donovan. They're still Sean Donovan. And they're trying to make their escape because they've learned about this escape hatch that Douglas has let them know about. And Donovan, obviously, I mean, he's shot. It's pretty clear he's not going to make it, right? I mean, I think that's pretty clear throughout, and he's going to stay behind. But one of the things I really loved that they did from the very first, they have this really neat musical motif for his whole sequence, right? And they bring that back whenever he's on screen. And it really was effective in this whole sequence with him where he's staying there, because you hear it when he's talking, and then when he is killed eventually, because he makes kind of a last stand to let Louisa and River get away, they do this really effective flashback, right? Where you see it kind of flashes back to the first episode where he's there with Allison, right?
Catherine Waterston.
It just really worked. It was really like it made his character more poignant than I think otherwise would have been.
Yeah, it really justifies beginning with that big sequence as opposed to the superhero fight that the book begins with. I mean, we discussed in the first episode how doing that gave us a more cinematic opening that was more suitable to television. But now that you get to the end, you see that there's even more of a plan than that. It's very circular. It comes back to that. And it's not just either Pemberton or Tori Drum, whichever one of them wrote that motif for Sean Donovan. It's also the flashback, as you say, and just the fact that we met him as a hero. You know, I mean, we didn't know who he was, and sure, he was in a state of incompetence, caught naked going through files, but he was the person we were identifying with during that opening chase, the one who apparently wanted to win back this woman who didn't trust him anymore and we're following on this Bourne-like chase through Istanbul, who gets his heart crushed at the end of it. So the finale really justifies why you began that way, so that You know, I think in the show, we ultimately identify with him a lot more than we ever do in the book, at least that I recall, partly because of that introduction and partly because just of how sympathetically they present his storyline. And I think part of that may be because we don't actually lose a slow horse in this book, whereas a lot of books, one of the slow horses gets killed. This isn't one of them. So I think they wanted us to still really feel a death strongly, and it worked. You know, this character, he's not a slow horse, but he is one of the leads of this season.
Yeah.
He's the first one we meet. He has a complete arc. He has the romance of the season. It's all after the fact, but he's driven by love, what he's doing. I think that really worked well from this. And it's another reason I want to sort of binge watch all of them now, to see this season as a sort of complete piece at once, because it really does all come back to the beginning.
Well, and the other thing that I love is that we see Duffy, Sean Duffy, who is the head dog and in charge of this whole cleaning up this mess, quickly losing control, right? I mean, he's like kind of just not doing great, and like intercutting it between, takes a while, but we finally get back to Tierney and Taverner, and there's a great bit, right, where they're kind of talking about who's going to lose, right? And I just thought that was so good. You know, both of them are ready to shift the blame to the other one, depending on how things shake out. And they are both easily able to do that, right? I mean, I love that little interaction where they're like, you know, oh, well, I can easily say that this is your fault, but I could, you know, depending on how it falls, I could easily say it's your fault. So that was just so good.
Right. Because you get things like Tierney is very confident. Duffy has the situation under control. And then Diana makes her question that, does he? And then Tierney comes back with, yeah, you trained him well. Yeah. You know, like, so that line is, you know, loaded with double meaning. It's not just, yes, I'm confident in my man because he's well trained, but also, you're the one who trained him, so you're responsible for what he does here.
Yeah.
You know, it's a way to try to constantly push that responsibility back and forth between each other, as well as sort of boost their own team. You know, they both got Team Duffy or Team Slow Horses.
Yeah. Well, and the great one is where Tierney says, Duffy's good at his job. It immediately cuts to Duffy on site, not very good at his job. I love that. Anytime you can cut, have somebody saying one thing definitively and you cut to something that it shows them completely wrong, I love in film or television.
Yeah, and it just reemphasizes what we talked about before, that it may be a series about a specific group of screw-ups, but in Mick Herron's world, no one is competent. There's no such thing as the ultimate James Bond smooth competence in espionage. You know, like, everybody, whether they're Park or Slow Horses or something else, they've all got their limitations. They might have something they're good at, but they also have something that they're really not. And that's kind of, I think, Mick Herron's view of the workplace, you know, not of espionage specifically, but just of the modern workplace. And I think he's probably right, in my experience anyway.
No, I agree.
There isn't a ton of competence.
Yeah. Well, and going on to Shirley and Marcus, man, like, get them like a Lethal Weapon spinoff, right? Because they're so good in this last couple episodes here, I felt. Shirley ready to go to rock, paper, scissors over who's going to be the person to go against them.
Yep.
When she's like about to do it and she's like, promise me something. And Marcus immediately cuts in and he's like, yes, I'll help you get clean. She's just like, you sanctimonious, like all of the stuff with them was pure gold this episode. MVPs of this episode, I thought.
And we never get to find out what she actually wanted him to promise.
No,
do we
don't, which is part of the joy, right? I mean, like, that it was great. Like, was she going to say that? I don't think she was, but man, I wanted to hear what it was.
Yeah. And maybe she was, and she just doesn't like being undercut, you know.
Which could be. I think more likely she was going to say, promise me you'll throw all your CDs into the bin, right? I mean, that was more likely a Shirley response than anything, but it was so good.
Yeah, and the CD, of course, is something else that gets a great callback.
Yes.
You know, seeds planted earlier the payoff in this finale.
That was great. Yeah, and right from the book too, which was nice to see. But yeah, I had forgotten about that. And then I saw it, I was like, oh yes, that's perfect. I think all of their stuff was great. I mean, and what, Shirley has her gun not work, and then Marcus either runs out of bullets or his jams up. He needs to get some better stuff in his trunk. That's all I'm going to say.
But then what's great is that Duffy is, ultimately facing down Marcus, and he's making fun of him for having this bad stuff, and then his gun jams. And that also was set up because it's not actually his stuff. You know, he didn't prepare it. He took it from one of the Citadel guys. Yeah, so he got it from a team that he's already criticized as being like wannabe soldier boys, you know, but he's so mad and he needs a gun. It's a funny scene where he just like grabs the gun from the guy next to him and goes off. But of course, this means he hasn't checked his equipment and he's professing to be, you know, the ultimate professional and criticizing Marcus for not checking his equipment and then his gun jams. And it's just so many great setup and payoff again and again.
Yeah, I mean, if there's any episode where you want to do that, that's this final episode, right? And it's so good. Again, with Marcus and Shirley, you know, they eventually take out everybody that they need to, which you expect to a certain extent, but the way they do it is pretty surprising. I mean, Shirley gets the car keys to Marcus's car and then proceeds to run down a bunch of the Citadel guys and take them out, which is just great. I mean, all of that stuff I loved. And yeah. Then Marcus, gets in this fight with Duffy. And Duffy, I mean, here's the thing that I think was really interesting this season especially is, they did a nice job of kind of making Duffy somebody that you don't mind getting taken down, right? I mean, he's not terrible, but he's also not great, right? And so it was fun to see him kind of lose control and just kind of walk that line a little bit. I don't know. What did you think about that?
Oh, yeah. No, they definitely wanted us to be rooting against him. And yeah, I think in the book, he's a little more of a gray area figure, you know, like he is kind of doing his job, even if his job is enacting the will of Ingrid Turney. But in this, they've gone out of their way. You know, they had him kill the new character who, you know, you were questioning why they'd added this guy, this nerdy keeper of the records who quotes Lord of the Rings and stuff. And it becomes clear, you know, they add him so that Duffy can kill him and we'll feel bad about that. Because again, we don't have a death of an actual slow horse. So he's another character that's sort of in there to really make us root against Duffy because we see him do this. Because you can't have him kill off one of our main characters that we know from the books who doesn't die in the book. I think that would be going too far. But you can create your own character and have him do that. So, yeah, by the end of this, we're really rooting against Duffy. And if you've read the book and you know what's coming, like, that's all very clear of why. Because what happens to Duffy, although it's not quite the same, but it's bad, you know? And I think in the book, we're supposed to feel the gray area of it. Whereas in the show, again, in a more cinematic way, you can feel good about rooting against Duffy.
Well, yeah, I mean, definitely in the book, and that was one of the things that's a slight difference from the book and the TV show, right? In the book, I think River takes him out.
Yeah.
And kind of knocks him, like, basically puts him in a coma.
I mean, it's very similar to what happens, what Louisa does here. River brains him with a brick.
Yeah.
And again, sort of like, you know, again and again in the series, Heron plays with these things where the things that we see on TV or in movies that always kill people aren't actually these surefire death things. And likewise, things that you think might be innocuous cartoon violence really do kill people. You know, we're going to see that in two seasons. We'll see the most extreme example of that. But like, you know, you had in the book, Spider-Web was put into a coma by what happens to him at the end of the last season. We already discussed how that was changed. But in the books, too, when River's original partner, Sid, River's first partner from season one, is played memorably by Olivia Cooke, in the books, it's very ambiguous at the end what happened to her. You know, in the show, it was also ambiguous, but they don't dwell on it quite as much. But it's like, no, Diana Taverner pulls her puppet strings and people disappear, bodies disappear, living people disappear, people in comas disappear. You know, like, we don't know, but MI5 apparently has this vast network of hospitals for comatose agents that they can move them around to. And so Sid may be in a coma or maybe dead. We're not sure. Spider was definitely in a coma in the books. That didn't happen here. He's now very definitely dead on this series. And Nick Duffy in the book is very clearly left brain damaged, which River feels kind of bad about too. He didn't like the guy, but I don't think he wanted to brain damage a fellow MI5 officer either. And here it's a little more, you know, they've really built him up as a black hat. You know, he's a villain, and we want to see him get his comeuppance, and he does, and it's Louisa. And you can see why they redistributed some of that to give everyone their sort of heroic moments at the end. I guess it's not totally clear that Duffy is dead, but it certainly seemed like it. And we definitely don't have Diana revealing to Lamb at the end that he is alive, but may never function again,
yeah.
You know, the way that she does in the book.
Well, let's jump to Lamb, because we get his sequence, and I'm just going to say it. I'm going to lay my cards out here as an 80s kid, big fan of the A-Team, and getting some very A-Team vibes from his whole section of this story here, right? Because we've got Hobbs and this other Citadel guy coming after them in the farmhouse, and Lamb has gone full-on Hannibal, you know, dropping the Pringles on the stairs to make noise. He's got the...
But eating one while he does.
Of course he is. Of course. Well, come on. That's a given. You know, sticking the knife through the banister. You know, he's got all of that going on here, right? What did you think about that whole section? Because it really did give me some A-Team flashbacks.
Yeah, and I suppose you could even read his dressing down when another character makes a strange decision and saying, "What? Explain to me your thought process here," as sort of the antithesis of "I love it when a plan comes together." But I don't know. What it really made me think of, though, was Skyfall and Home Alone, which, you know, a lot of people had compared the end of Skyfall to Home Alone when it happened, because you have Bond creating all these traps in his old family home out of regular things that are around, rather than having Q's gadgets. And this is what we've got going on here. It's Christmas. I've been watching Home Alone. You know, they've both been on TV. So that's the main thing that I'm thinking about when Lamb is doing this. It's his Home Alone shtick. And I don't remember it from the book. I mean, did all that stuff happen in the book? I really don't recall.
I don't remember it being as kind of Home Alone A-Team-esque. You know, might there have been a little bit of that, perhaps, but I didn't recall that. You know, and it's, again, I've not read in a year or two, so I'm a little fuzzy, but no, it felt much more cinematic, frankly.
Exactly. And again, it's the difference in mediums, because in the book, as my recollection, and it's also been years since I've read this book, but my recollection is that it's explained by that kind of Lamb magic that you can get away with on the page, where despite the descriptions of Lamb, of he's so slovenly and he's so everything, you know, like he doesn't seem physically fit at all, but he can move like a ninja when he has to.
Yeah.
And you can sort of do that on the page. We've described this very fat man, more so than Oldman ever even appears to be, and who can then like move like a ballerina up these stairs without making a sound when he has to, you know, and I think that my recollection is that's basically what happens at the end, is where we're described Lamb is a sort of, he's almost a force of nature when he goes into action. Like, you don't expect him to be good at it, and then he can just kill people. He is and this happens again and again throughout the books, he is a bad MF-er when he needs to be. But on a show, you kind of do need to show it, you know, like you can't just magic it out with a sort of plot ninja stuff of like, yeah, I don't know how he does it. You've got to actually show how he does it. And that's what they do show.
Well, and I love at the start, you know, Hobbs is kind of waiting to go in there. And he's actually right for once. Like, he's so often, this is the MI5 guy, he's so often wrong. And this is the one time where he's like, actually right. You might want to take a second and figure out what's going on. Because something's not right here.
Yeah, he's got a new dog with him. And he's telling him, yeah, you don't go up against Jackson Lamb, and the new guy's like, isn't he the guy who has all the screw-ups? And he's like, yeah, but he's a legend too. And the other guy doesn't heed his call and almost gets his face blown off for it.
Yes, yeah, because he blowed the bloody doors off, as those Brits would say. Yes. No, I love that. And, you know, that whole sequence really felt suspenseful, right? Because, you know, Lamb has hidden Catherine away in a closet. He's given Sarah Dunn this job. You know, she's the one that's supposed to shoot as soon as she hears the crinkling of the Pringles on the stairs. And there's this really nice moment where she's moving, but he sees the light coming through the stairway and realizes that and fires at her. And I love that whole sequence where she ends up going after him and trying to shoot him, but falls down the stairs. It's so slow horses, right? It's not your typical action sequence. You would normally blow everybody's heads off. She's falling down the stairs and then puts him in a headlock to take him out. I love that kind of stuff.
Yeah, but it's interesting too what it does with perspective here, because we follow Lamb as he's laying these traps, putting the Pringles on the stairs, stuffing Catherine into a closet and stuff. But then we don't. We were like, what's he doing? We know he goes out. He's out on the roof looking down. But basically our perspective becomes those two dogs, Hobbs and the new guy. And because of the way they build it up, with Hobbs, as you said, being kind of smart here and saying we got to be careful against this guy, they're almost who we're following. So it sort of becomes this horror movie where they're our nubile teenagers and Lamb is Michael Myers, you know, like he's lurking out there. They're going through this house and we're like, oh my God, what is going to happen to them? And sure enough, horrible things do happen to them.
That's great. Yes. Slow horses as the new Halloween movie. That's great. But, you know, we also get Roddy, who is preparing to help. You know, he kind of gets like, I don't know, some sort of like stick or something. He's going to go in there. And then he starts hearing the shooting and runs.
Yeah, what was he going to do with that stick or whatever he had?
I don't know. I don't think he knew. But, you know, he was going to try something. But yeah. Then he comes back. He's like, time to change the game. And he starts messing with the bus. And, this was the one thing I've got to say throughout the whole series I was hoping they would keep in. I was not sure. And then you get that flash to the double-decker bus, and I'm like, oh, they're going to do it. Yes, I hope so. Yeah. Fingers crossed. And we get it, right? Because Lamb has gone through, like, they've taken out the guys. And let's just jump back to that, because we see, I think, is it Hobbs is going towards the closet?
Yeah, where Catherine is.
Where Catherine is, and he's about to take her out. And it's just brutal, this. He takes him out. Lamb takes him out with a headshot. It's really one of the most brutal moments that we have in this episode, I would say.
From behind. I mean, like, yeah. Lamb is not someone, you know, there's no sense of, like, fair play here.
No.
Which, of course, is absolutely correct. You know, like, he behaves exactly how you would expect. You know, like, we're a river. He might be like, turn around, you know, like, put if he comes up behind him with a gun, you know, put your hands up.
Yeah, drop your gun, yeah.
Right. Yeah, Lamb's not going to do that. He's not going to take those chances. If he gets the drop on him, he's going to press his advantage, and he does. He blows his brains out from behind.
Well, and then Catherine comes out, and she's like, did you put me in there as bait? And Lamb's like, you're fine. It worked out. Don't worry about it. Right? Like, obviously, yes, that's exactly what he did, which is just great. He's so, so funny. Like, really great at that stuff. And we get another moment with Sarah, which I just love, where Catherine, who is always concerned about the other people, right? She's always concerned about somebody else. She's like, Sarah, are you okay? And then Sarah's just like, sort of, just kill the man. Which I thought was great too. Like, she was, I really liked her character. She grew on me as the season went, and she was really good too.
Yeah, and she still gets two more big moments after that. Before we can get to one of them, we got to get back to Roddy and the bus. And for me too, this is the moment that I've been waiting for. You know, it's such a memorable moment to anyone who reads the books. I never for a second didn't think they would include it. Like, you know, it had to be. You got to deliver this.
Well, Lamb hears it coming. He hears something and he's like, tells everybody back away, and Roddy bursts through the front of the house in the double-decker bus. I mean, in the book and in the series, this is the moment that Roddy kind of really comes to the fore. I feel like this book, especially Catherine, Roddy, everybody really comes fully formed. And this moment was what did it for me, for Roddy.
Yeah.
I don't know what you thought.
Yeah. Oh, no, this is Roddy. This is Roddy's heroic moment in the book and in here. It's his big moment, and it is delightfully unheroic. You know, it's just, he thinks he's making his big move, and again, adapting to the cinema, because in the books, you kind of get this italicized interior monologue for Roddy Ho a lot. And he thinks that he's a hero. You'll hear him thinking these things, but in the show, they actually have him talking it out. He gives himself a tagline when he gets on the bus. He played appropriate music, or what he thought was appropriate music before. He's like, this is how I be an action hero, you know?
Yeah.
And none of it is. It's all very clearly not what... So he smashes this double-decker bus through the front of the house after everybody's already dead. The bad guys are dead, you know, and the good guys have won. And, you know, in the post-battle, as the dust is settling, that's when Lamb hears something, you know, and tells people to get back. And this bus smashes through the front of the house. And Lamb is just incredulous and asks him, explain your thinking here. And Roddy's just like, I drove the bus through the house.
He's like, yeah, take out the bad guys.
And Lamb's like, we'd already done that.
Well, and Sarah, I love too. She's like, what did you do to my house?
Yeah. And this is one of those other Sarah moments I was talking about. You know, again, she's like, will insurance cover this? And Lamb's like, no, I don't think insurance will cover this.
I think what he says is like deliberate destruction by an effing idiot. Meanwhile, you have Roddy taking selfies outside of the house. I mean, the whole thing, it was just so good. It was so great. It was everything I had hoped from that moment.
Yeah, absolutely.
Jumping back, they get out of the hatch. I mean, you know, it felt like a little bit like an episode of Lost here. They're trying to open the hatch. They make it out, and there's so many great moments around this, like, escape for where River and Louisa are getting out, and Shirley and Marcus are finally helping rescue them.
Yeah.
I mean, first, we get Shirley telling Marcus, are you mansplaining a gun to me? And then Marcus is like, it's a rifle, actually.
Yeah.
So many great one-liners here.
I had remembered Marcus being slightly more effective in this battle in the book. Am I wrong? Like, was it always?
I think you're right. I mean, I think both of them were pretty on par, and I think they upped the kind of like incompetence a little bit with both of them in this action sequence here versus the books.
Uh-huh.
But all of it really emphasized the buddy comedy of the two characters that,
yeah,
I like, is so good. God, it's so great, the two of them together. All of the stuff, like when Shirley drives his car and just uses it to run down these guys and gets shot up. I mean, all of that stuff was so great. You know, Marcus at the end, when they're talking about going back to Slough House because they were fired, but they're like, well, you know, maybe not now. And he's, Marcus is like, I doubt I'll be hanging out at home when Cassie sees the car, right?
Yeah.
Marcus and Shirley, you can tell they are bonded from this experience, and they're ride or dies after this.
Yeah, which, you know, will definitely pay off in the next season. It's great to see their relationship really coming together the way it does in the books. After this season, there's no question about this actress playing Shirley for me. She, like we said in the first episode, just putting her with Marcus made her so much more the Shirley we know from the books.
Yeah.
And by the end of the season, you know, the two of them have played it so well that, yeah, I'm completely on board. Can't wait for more. Yeah, I'm completely sold on our screen Shirley, and mostly on our screen Marcus. He's still not quite who I pictured, mainly because he's younger than I pictured, but he's terrific and they're terrific together. Yeah, I can't wait for more of them.
Yeah. Well, and so River escapes from the hatch and kind of takes the file and goes on a runner.
Well, I mean, first, the escape itself is pretty great, where Shirley has a grenade and throws this grenade down the hatch to the Citadel guys who are pursuing them. I mean, there's a very high body count here. And it's true in the book, too. You know, like, this is by far the highest body count so far in the series. Like, it's a big shootout, you know, and a lot of people die. And it's sort of atypical for the series up to that point, and that's why it's so memorable. And same for the show, you know, it wasn't what we got out of the first two seasons, but it is the new normal. I think they have upped the body count from the, you know, the book had high body count. I think it's even higher here in the show, which makes sense again for television. But yeah, getting them out of the hatch and leaving with that grenade was just the best way to do it.
The other part is we finally see that Ingrid Tierney has lost. There's this one moment her and Taffer are having it out. Tierney says, you know, they're slow horses. I call it mercy killing, which was just brutal, but like, ooh, so good too, right? I mean, all of their stuff is great.
But especially brutal after she personally sent River on this mission, you know?
Yeah.
This version of Tierney is not the book's version. The book's version is much more over the top, almost more cinematic, weirdly, from everything we've been discussing. But, you know, she's a character from Roald Dahl's The Witches. She's got this, she's bald and she changes her wig. You know, she really, she feels like a wicked witch, which I never got from this Tierney, who's a more real kind of character. But yeah, that we do get the same kind of indiscriminate ruthlessness from her. And when you realize that it's not for the state security or anything, this is all about covering her own ass and keeping her job. She really is a pretty despicable character. And I love that her final move with Diana is just to take the bottle. You know, she'd come in before in this great scene in the last episode where she brings this nice bottle of scotch that Diana bought for her when she got first desk, and then she saved it and they're drinking it, but it has other significances that, and then she just takes it with her. If it were a more equitable rivalry, someone might have left the bottle as a show of, okay, may the best woman win while you did, but nope, not here. Like, she takes the bottle with her and leaves.
Cutting back to Lamb and Catherine, this is where we get to really the biggest kind of emotional moment. Well, I don't know. There's two emotional moments, I'd say, left in this episode. And one of the biggest is with Catherine and Lamb, because Catherine keeps going on about her former boss, Charlie Partner, Saint Charlie Partner, as Lamb puts it. And wow, you can just... the tension, you can see Lamb / Oldman really kind of, the more she talks about him, the more he is getting riled up. And I just love that whole sequence there where he finally lays into her and reveals the truth about what happened to her former boss and what was going on there.
And this is one of the great things about adaptation, that you can rewrite, you know, and it's like we saw Le Carre rewriting his own second novel, A Murder of Quality, when he wrote the TV screenplay decades later. And he writes about how he had a chance to like rewrite it later and improve things. I think we discussed that. And I said that for me, I actually prefer his original book. But here we're seeing that. And it's not Heron rewriting himself. It's Will Smith, I believe. Was Smith the writer of this episode?
I think so, yeah.
But, I mean, maybe Heron was involved. I mean, we know that he has some involvement in the writer's room. I'd love to know if it was something that he was thinking, because he might have gotten feedback over the years. But this scene is greatly improved from what it is in the book. What you just said of how we see her really driving Lamb to this revelation. And she's going on and on with her hero worship about Charles Partner, who Lamb knows to have been a traitor. He's one of only two people who knows that Partner was a Russian double at the top of MI5 and did away with him. He knows this, and he knows why he was using Catherine, and eventually he's had enough and he tells her. And it just, it makes total sense. It all tracks. And the director deserves credit here because he really takes the time. The editor deserves credit. They let it build. You know, there's no quick cutting here. It lets this build. Whereas in the book, it's one of my least favorite moments, even though this is my favorite book or one of my favorites. But that moment just, it feels out of character. We don't really know why Lamb tells her this piece of information at the end of the book. It seems just to be cruel. And he tells her the part about because you're a drunk. And it just seems so cruel in the book. It's like, why is he doing this after he's gone to all this trouble to rescue someone he cares about? And I guess the intent may have been that he has to cut down relationships because he can't have them, which she calls him out for there. But it seems needlessly cruel to give her that information and say that he kept her around because she was a drunk. And I just think it tracks so much better here. It really works. You get why he does that. And he gives her this bombshell here, and it just feels cruel and almost, even for a character who thrives on his own cruelty, almost uncharacteristically cruel.
Because you saw Catherine, it was like each time she's like kind of driving a nail into him, right? She's like,
yeah.
He talked about how people don't want to see the decent side of you. You know, Charles was an honorable man. She says, mm-hmm. He thought you could be first X. You know, all of this stuff. You just kind of see it like hitting him each time, like all of these things until he finally can't handle it and he breaks.
What we haven't gotten on the show that was a big part of the book was Catherine's real battle with her alcoholism, because, you know, she's talking to a wine bottle throughout her captivity in the book.
Yeah.
Is she going to do it? Is she going to break down and drink? You're always worried about it. And we really, even though the show, as you said, focuses on addiction, we really didn't get that after the AA meeting at the beginning. It doesn't go that much again into Catherine's addiction until the end. When it does it here, and we realize why she was kept around by this first desk who she adored and hero worships, specifically because she was a drunk, and she's not going to realize what he's up to, you know, selling secrets to the Soviets. It's brutal, but also it tracks, you know, why Lamb is going to burst out and reveal it at that point. But we get that gut punch, you know, of emotion that Catherine feels. It's not just that the person that she idolized more than anything has been pushed off his pedestal, but it's also that he used her, like, very yeah. specifically, and used her addiction. And that has to hurt more than anything.
Well, and we get this great moment where, like, Lamb is, he didn't even do it because it was ideological. That I could at least understand, which I love, right? He just did it because of yeah. money, you know, all of that. And it all leads to this moment where Lamb pushes her. Does it sound like a lie or something you knew but didn't want to admit?
Yeah.
And it's almost like she's having a
moment of clarity.
Moment of clarity, or like, it's almost like she's having an intervention from Jackson Lamb, right? Where she's been in denial. She's made it through her alcoholism, but she's having an intervention about Charles' partner and having to realize she was a part of that and she knew what was going on, but she didn't want to admit it.
Yeah.
And that's where we get her dropping her, fuck you, Jackson Lamb. You know, which is for her, wow. I mean, that's such a big moment, I thought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's certainly kind of the emotional climax of the show.
It felt like it.
And then we get River, and he brings the file. You know, what's he going to do with this file that Sean Donovan gave his life for, that so did...
Ben?
Yeah, Ben. And that the Catherine Waterston character originally gave her life for... what's River going to do with it? And he takes it to the one guy that he really respects, just in the same way that Catherine respects the late Charles' partner. He brings it to his grandfather, the OB. And again, this doesn't happen in the book, I don't think.
I don't think River was the person that releases that, from what I remember.
No, my recollection was that Lamb gives it to Taverner in his meeting with her, when yeah. the meeting still happens. But I think he, like... Because I seem to remember him teasing her with it. You know, he brings it and he sort of hands it to her and then takes it back and eventually gives it to her as part of his quid pro quo with her, and sort of assures his protection from any of the fallout from this by giving her the file. But no, here we have River bringing it to his granddad, which I don't think happened. Again, it's been a while since I read it. I could be wrong, but I believe this is invented now for the television, and it works. It works well. It gives us another sort of emotional gut punch that we'll get into in a minute, and it sets up next season for those who have, you know, ran ahead in the books. Bringing in the OB to the end of this season is a really good way to kind of prime us for what's going to happen next season.
Well, the OB proves his name, why he got that name in this, right? Because he just has a brutal takedown of River over what Tierney did and what isn't in the file. And it's just like harsh, man. It's like River should be feeling like garbage after this.
Yeah, he really, as you say, he lives up to his name, and he shows that he is service above everything, whereas Diana had earlier taken Tierney to task for putting herself above the service, you know, saying that she did it all for the service, but really, no, you did it for your own career advancement. Now, we know in the series, in the TV series from season one, the very end of season one, we saw a flashback of the OB and Jackson Lamb conspiring to kill Charles' partner. So this is all information that doesn't come out until, you know, later on in the book series, but we got it from the very end of the first season in the show. And now it's really paying off because, again, we see the OB's absolute dedication to the service no matter what. And in this case, it's not arranging the murder of his boss and friend. In this case, it's really dressing down his beloved grandson. This is River's closest familial connection, his grandfather. And like you say, previously we've seen him sort of giving some twinkle in the eye advice on spying. But here he gives him a dressing down, like you say. He points out what's not in the file. You know, you're not going to, there's no smoking gun here. It's not going to, and just as soon as you see the fire in the fireplace near him, you're worried about, you know what's going to happen to the file.
Okay, let's count it down. How long are we from this being tossed into the fire, right?
Yeah.
Which happens, and it's just like, you know, River, of course, walks out to the car, and he's got a copy, and you're like, okay, I see where this is going. Really, that felt like the end. And then we get this little kind of, if like we were reading a book, it would say epilogue, right? And we get Lamb and Taverner back out on the canal doing their little walk and talk. We find out River has leaked that file. Tierney is gone. And it seems like Taverner has kind of climbed to the top of the heap finally, right?
I was a little confused by River leaking the file. Like, what was the file that was on the seat when he got back to the car? Was it just something that had fallen out of the file before he gave it to his granddad?
You saw that he had gone to like a quick copy place and made a copy of the file.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So he did suspect that his granddad might do something like that.
And we find out that Taverner is going to be dealing with a new home secretary. So Peter Judd has been moved on. And we get the kicker at the end, right? Where Taverner is like, do you think you're happier than I am at Slough House? Lamb's like, yes, and I'm miserable, which is great. That's kind of the end of this season. So before we get to the trailer, because I know I want to talk about that too. I totally do. But what did you think overall this season? Thumbs up, thumbs down?
Oh, thumbs way up. Thumbs way up.
Yeah.
It's great. You know, I mean, from the start, I think I said this seems like it's going to be my favorite season, and I'd say it is. You know, this was my favorite season. I mean, not vastly, because it's all been of such a high quality level, you know, that it's not like it's night and day, but it was a great season working from one of the best books that really delivers on it, gives us everything we want, makes improvements in certain places, and makes it all more televisual. It was really excellent. I loved it.
I'd agree. I thought it was great. And I talked about this last episode. The only thing I'd give it was that Catherine and her addiction and her alcoholism, I thought, in a way that we didn't see this season, that I really missed. I missed that. I loved that bit of it. And I totally understand why it's hard to put on TV. It doesn't make me miss it any less, but I get it.
Yeah, I wonder if they ever considered anthropomorphizing a wine bottle and having it talking to her. And then there's going to be a character in a later book who has a similar thing where she talks to a bullet who speaks with a Poirot voice. And I'll be interested to see if they find a way to do that. But my guess is this is setting the blueprint, and no, that's a literary device, and we'll see something different in the television version.
Yeah, so that would be my minor ding to it, but overall, wonderful adaptation. I loved it. It was great. And so
I think that there is a criticism that could be made of it by people who are just watching the series and haven't read the books. I could understand. I haven't seen these reviews yet, but I could understand if some people feel that it is a concession to the genre and giving us more of a slam bang action thing than, you know, oh no, this is a Le Carre like cerebral spy show that's traded in, it's turned to the enemy, and it's gone to the Jason Bourne side now, and it's an action show, and I'm sad about that. You know, I could see people thinking that, but if you read the books, you know the whole series takes twists and turns, and you know, some of the books are more action oriented, some are more desk oriented. It balances the two pretty well overall. But yeah, I could see people having that complaint that this might be more action. But I don't know. I think it delivered the action in such a slow horse's way. It was never off brand. You know, it's not like it turned into Rambo, which they do make an allusion to that. But there's a lot of dead bodies at the end. But it's always slow horses along the way.
Yeah, I agree. I think you're right. There could be some dings there. But I think it's all coming from the book. I mean, I don't think there was any action really that we saw that was dramatically different from what we saw in the novel. And so I think for folks who have read the novels, I think that would ring pretty hollow. But yes, I certainly could see how this seems of a different tone and tenor than perhaps the other couple seasons. But again, like, I think we'll watch some future seasons where it's very different. I'm thinking of a few books where, you know, you'll see something dramatically different from that. So, yeah. All right. So let's jump into that trailer because, like, we got to talk about it a little bit. I've watched a couple times. Frankly, it's everything I'd hoped for from the next season I'm seeing in this trailer. I don't know what you thought, but, like, wow. If you've read the books, you're like, yes, yes, yes. Check, check, check.
Yeah.
I'm loving this. What do you think?
Yes, for the most part, but it also raises some huge questions of, you know, it seems from the trailer like they've made some significant departures in the next season. But overall, yes, you know, it's like, and that's one of the great things about the show, how they film two seasons at a time and they're ahead of the game so we can get these trailers at the end. You know, I love it that, you know, you finish a season and you get a whole trailer, not just a teaser.
So great. It's like probably to their detriment, honestly, that they do this because it makes people want to see that next season so much more. But I love it. It's great.
Yeah, it looks fantastic. I mean, it was like watching the greatest hits of the book, you know, like reminding me of everything that I really liked about that book. You know, like, oh boy, I got a lot to look forward to next season. But, yeah, there's some significant changes. Well, and also we get to see our first glimpse of one of my favorite characters from the series, Emma Flight, who she seems to be cast very appropriately. I mean, in the book, she's described as just being ethereally beautiful, like, which is weird to have the job that she has. She'll be the next top dog after Nick Duffy. But in the show, it looks from this, you know, I mean, clearly the actress is stunning. They've cast a very beautiful actress, but she's not like this kind of, in the books, it's just so much made of her beauty that it seems like some sort of supermodel. But when you think about a workplace and who looks like a supermodel at your workplace, you know, you're judging from by different standards, you know, so it makes much more sense to have someone who is super beautiful, but not like TV super beautiful, you know, like she still feels like she'll be realistic and fit in with this world. Because, I mean, there's a million actresses from Bond movies or other glamorous spy entertainment, you know, who might not actually fit in with a real world espionage, you know, but it doesn't look like they've gone that road. So that's cool. I mean, this is based on several seconds of footage. I'm I don't mean to, but it's just, it's a character I like a lot. So I'm happy to see that she looks well cast. But yeah, we also get some differences from the book. The biggest one being that it appears, and this could be misleading in the trailer, but both from the conversation that happens at the end of this and the trailer, it appears that Diana is going to be first desk in the next season. Did you get that impression?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
So because of some people that we see with her, I saw a character that looked very much like a character that we see that ends up as first desk.
Oh, okay. I'll have to watch it again. I didn't...
Yeah, first time I didn't notice it, but when you see what's happening and who she's with, you get the sense, oh, wait, no, there's somebody there who is playing that character. And so, fingers crossed, I think that that's not going to be the case. Because, yes, I definitely thought that first time through watching this episode and then that trailer, so...
Yeah, and in the conversation at the end of this one, it really seems like Diana is assuming the mantle of first desk. Granted, this could all be to pull the rug out from under her in a great comical way at the beginning of the next season.
Yeah, we'll have to see how it shakes out.
Of course, what we also get is our first look at the major antagonist of next season, played by a very recognizable actor, Agent Smith from The Matrix.
Hugo Weaving, yes. Ooh, he was so good just from that, like, literal, like, 5 seconds that we see him.
Yeah, and I can't wait to see him in full. He's going to fit into this world very well, I think.
Well, unfortunately, rumor is that we won't see this till next Christmas, this season 4. There's discussions about something that kind of starts off this whole season is Christmas themes. So folks are saying, oh, it might take a while. And you know, folks are also saying it might be until next November again, when we see the next season, which I'm hopeful that we're wrong on, but I also feel like might be accurate just based on everything after the strike and getting things rolling again to get another season going.
It could be because of the marketplace we're in right now that every content provider is facing a year with less content than they normally have, and they want to stretch it and make it last, especially these subscription-based ones like Apple. So I could see them, yeah, doing that, which is too bad because we know that they're shooting the next two already, right?
No, I don't think they have dates on the books to start filming the next two. I know they're breaking and writing the next two is from what I've heard.
Oh, okay.
But I don't think they're actually recording at this time. I think they actually, what I read is they still need to do a few pickups the last season, season 4. They basically filmed most of it, but they had just a couple of days shooting left. But, you know, definitely most of that season's in the can, so it's just going to be a while of sitting around waiting for them to release it. Hopefully they get back into production soon so that we can see more sooner than that. You know, I'm fingers crossed we get like October, November, a new season, and then maybe we get another season in June or July. That would be my dream kind of outcome of this whole thing.
Yeah, because 6 episodes isn't many. But then again, there is the adage of leaving wanting more, and they've done that. You know, I can't wait for the next batch at the end of this one.
Well, and the good news is it gives a little extra time to Heron to write some more novels. So that's not a bad thing either.
Yeah, that's true. One more thing that we didn't discuss, which is just that in the book, I felt more from this one, from River and Louisa Guy, that Heron was teasing us with a possible romance there.
Mm.
For people who've read further into the books, you'll obviously know which direction that ends up going. But at this stage in this book, that's what I remember thinking when I was reading this book. There was a potential burgeoning romance between River and Louisa at the end, even if it was much more one-sided at the end of the book. I didn't feel that this season. You know, they were great together. They, you know, I loved their repartee, but I didn't get quite the romantic tension there that I did from the book. And I think that, you know, again, I see why. Like, maybe this is something I brought to the book. I don't know. Did you have that feeling from the book?
I'd agree with that.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm being a little spoilery by saying this for the books, but I feel like this is one of those things where the benefit of reading ahead and knowing what comes has sort of influenced how they played it, you know?
Mm.
But yeah, I didn't get that from the show. And that's okay. But it's just, it is a different feeling than I had in the book.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about that relationship. But all of these relationships are kind of different. And so we'll see how it all plays out in the show, because I do get different senses from everybody and how they're interacting just based on some stuff. It stays close to the books, but it also strays a little bit. So I'm curious to see how they play things out going forward.
Yeah.
Because, you know, one of the things that we don't see, one of the threads they never kind of close in, is this whole lost diamond thread that we kind of get in the books, but we didn't get here. So I'm curious to see how that plays out in future seasons.
Yeah. Can't wait.
Well, I was hoping to just squeeze in. I've heard a debate of whether Lam is the protagonist, the main character of the Slaughterhouse series, or whether it's a ensemble piece. I wanted to get your opinion on that, but I think we've run out of time. Maybe that'll have to be a special episode. We'll do a roundtable and have folks make their points and get into that, because I have opinions, but I want to hear what other folks say about that.
Yeah, and one particularly interesting thing would be whether the answer is the same for the books or the TV show, because I'm not sure it is.
I think that would be maybe where I fall. But we're going to leave folks wanting more. Thank you, Matthew, for joining me yet again to talk Slow Horses. And I'm sure you'll be back, but I just really appreciate talking about this with you. You're a expert in the spy field, the cinema field, and the Slow Horses field. So thanks again, as always, for joining me.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Well, that's going to wrap up this look at the season of Slow Horses. We will be back in just a couple of weeks with a look at The Secret Hours. I talked with Tim Shipman from the Sunday Times, and he will be talking through that whole book with me. I'm really excited to release that to folks.
I can't wait to hear that.
Well, I'm glad I have at least one listener on that one. Hopefully a few more, fingers crossed. And I also am really hopeful to have a couple other episodes coming up in the future in 2024 that I think folks will enjoy listening to. We'll space them out a little bit further than once a week, but should be some good stuff coming up. If you enjoyed the show, feel free to rate us in whatever your preferred podcast app is. Feel free to drop me a line. You can either go to spyride.com and comment there, or go on Twitter. You can find me at Barbican Station. Drop a comment there as well. Until next time, thanks for listening.
Like what you're listening to? There's more like it. Exploring the works of John le Carré, each episode of the Le Carré Cast looks at a specific novel or an unexplored aspect of his life and work. Join us as we take a deep dive into the world of espionage John le Carré has revealed. Search for Le Carré Cast wherever you listen to podcasts or at lecarrecast.com. Spybrary's Spy Rewind uses one episode of a classic spy TV show like Mission Impossible, Alias, or Get Smart to talk about the show as a whole. It's at spybrary.com or search for Spybrary in your podcast app. Like the Wolf is a podcast dedicated to the Nero Wolfe mystery series created by Rex Stout. The podcast has reviews of all of his stories, plus interviews with a wide variety of Wolf fans. Find it in your podcatcher under Like the Wolf or at likethewolf.com. That's Wolf with an E. They're all novel podcasts, and you can find them all if you type novel.network in your browser. That's novel.network.